Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today on Studio Tulsa, we feature an interview from our archives with last year's winner of the Peggy V. Helmrich Distinguished Author Award, Hilary Mantel, best known for her historical novels on the life of Thomas Cromwell, the 16th century advisor to King Henry VIII and Cardinal Wolsey. Those books, Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, were both awarded Britain's top literary award, the Man Booker Prize, in 2009 and 2012, respectively. The novels were later adapted to the stage by the Royal Shakespeare Company and to the screen by the BBC Masterpiece Consortium in a six-part miniseries. The latter starred Mark Rylance as Cromwell. The final volume of the Cromwell trilogy, The Mirror and Light, is due out next year in March of 2020. Mantel studied law and began her professional life as a social worker, then moved with her husband to Botswana for 5 years, then Saudi Arabia for 4 before returning to Britain. Those experiences played a role in her early fiction. She's the author of 11 novels in total and 2 short story collections, one of which is her most recent publication, The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher Stories. I spoke with Mantel back in December prior to her Tulsa appearance. Hilary Mantel, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and congratulations on winning the Helmrich Award.
Thank you very much.
Until the past half century or so, the person you've been writing about for the past decade, Thomas Cromwell, was often thought of as simply a villainous caricature or a flunky. That scholarship has changed over the past half century, but he was more along the lines of how he's portrayed in A Man for All Seasons. What first attracted you to this historical character of the past?
I think when you look at the reign of Henry VIII, which is so much studied in UK, and of course all the world knows Henry VIII and his 6 wives. He's our most famous king, if you like. You look at this reign and the story's been told and told and told again, but there's something missing, and it's Thomas Cromwell. And this was a minister who was at the center of everything during the years, during the reign's most dynamic decade, the 1530s, when really the whole face of England changed. And so you ask yourself, what is this black hole? What is this moving area of darkness? This is Thomas Cromwell. Why am I only seeing him as a caricature or a stereotype, this black-cloaked villain coming after the king with an axe, cutting down the opposition? You think there must be more to it than that. So I went in pursuit of what more there was to find, and it surprised me.
I was reading about the 1950s or 1960s, historians started reassessing Cromwell as sort of giving us some detail into this role, which you've wonderfully fleshed out within the court of Henry VIII. And was that a basis for some of your own scholarship, this idea that he, in fact, was, for lack of a better word, the political fixer for Henry VIII, first for Cardinal Wolsey, doing the bidding of Henry VIII, and then for the king himself?
That scholarship was absolutely an inspiration for me. But you quickly pick up from reading the academic text, you think, this man was a genius. He was a political genius. But as a person, he goes missing. The people who did that work in a previous generation, we're not really interested in what he was like as a man, and he is hard to find as a man because of his obscure early life and the lack of personal material. But I just thought there is a man in there. Behind this set of official papers, there's a person, and I want to go find him and see if I can make him walk and talk again.
How difficult was it to learn about his early life? He was a commoner. Most of the time, people really didn't write about commoners or didn't write about themselves, for that matter.
I think that's absolutely right. We don't even know his date of birth for sure. So we tend to say, well, it must have been around 1485. It's convenient because that's when the Tudor dynasty began, when the first Tudor, Henry VII, came to the throne. So we date him at the beginning of the dynasty he served. And we know that he was born just outside London, small town on the river. His father was a blacksmith and a brewer. He was a bit of a rough character with a minor criminal record. There's no record of Thomas Cromwell's education. But round about the age of 15, he seems to have run away from home. And he crossed the Channel and he joined the French army. And the French army were fighting in Italy, so off to Italy he went with them. And somehow then he ends up in the household of a very rich and prominent banker in Florence, from there Venice, Rome, and then back to Northern Europe. He set up in the wool trade in Antwerp, which was the great commercial centre of Northern Europe. By the way, he picked up languages and a lot of connections, which are rather shadowy, but obviously served him for the rest of his life. And then from Antwerp, back to London, and he's still only 30 or so. From there, into the service of the great Cardinal Wolsey, right-hand man to the king. And when Wolsey fell from power, he transferred into the king's service. And that's when he really comes onto the historical record.
So he's really a figure in the shadows with just bits and pieces about his life until what really becomes the momentous moment of his life when he enters the king's court as opposed to Wolsey's orbit.
Yes, I'm always fascinated by these moments when a person, as it were, steps into history. And one of my great pleasures was inventing what that first meeting with Henry VIII might have been like. It's always said that the first time Thomas Cromwell met Henry, he said to him, "I'm going to make you the richest king in Europe." And as you can imagine, Henry's piggy eyes lit up. Well, that's great. It would be a convenient story, but I don't believe it would have been quite as crass and simple as that. But it's probably one of these things that at the time nobody knew the importance of. Cromwell would be on Henry's radar. Perhaps maybe he didn't even know his name when he was in Wolsey's service. But after he stepped into the political scene, he very soon started shaping the political process to his own liking.
You know, what's really...
He was a very ambitious man.
Well, yes, he was.
He achieved great things for king and country as well as for himself.
He was very ambitious. He's also having to fight with his own, you know, he forsakes his religion because of the changes in England, church he's grown up with, a church that helped him get to where he was at the beginning.
Yes, this is true. Most men from an ordinary background who got on in life did it through the church. Wolsey, for example, was the son of a provincial butcher, though he was quite a well-off butcher who was able to send his son to university in Oxford. But nevertheless, it was a very humble background. But once Wolsey, who was very clever and also ambitious, got into the church structure, he was able to rise through its hierarchy. And once he was a cardinal, there he was at the top of the tree. Though people still muttered behind their hands, you know, his father was a butcher. So the church enabled Wolsey to get on. And the unusual thing is with Cromwell, he didn't enter the church. He didn't do it that way. He made his own ladder to climb up to the heights of office. So he moved outside the existing structure for a poor boy getting on in the world, did something new.
As a novelist, that must be a great connection, the fact that Wolsey and Cromwell both come from the most humble backgrounds.
Yes, They had, I think, a very warm relationship. Wolsey was also a genius of a kind. He was a public relations genius. He was an international figure. He was extremely flamboyant, extravagant, great patron of the arts. He had a golden career, and his fall from power, it's still really hard to explain because he was so close to the king. But when he fell, all the people who had got on through his patronage turned against him, and the only person to stick with him was Thomas Cromwell. And frankly, even Cromwell's worst enemies had to admit that he had been very loyal to his fallen master. And this appears to be one of the things that drew Henry to him. Because you picture this man, Henry, he's all powerful, but he doesn't think, or rather, he always doubts that anyone feels personal loyalty to him. He thinks, I'm the king, I can give out favours, of course they love me. But then you see someone like Cromwell, who's obviously motivated not quite in the usual way, and Henry thinks, I would like such a loyal man for my servant.
In the way you write, this relationship between Henry and Wolsey and Cromwell is a very complex one, because he can hold them in affections, and it was almost like he was subject to rages, and he would make pronouncements, and that person's enemies used those pronouncements to basically do the deed before Henry had a chance to reconsider in many ways.
Well, unfortunately, a king's impulses are very powerful and deadly, and Henry was a complex person, and one of the things I have tried to do is treat him as, most of the time, a rational being and try to work out why he made the choices he did. What was it in the political situation and his complex personality coming together that shaped the history of his era? Certainly, Wolsey's fall, there are many mysterious things about it, but it's the kind of thing that gathers force, you see. Once a man like that, who's reached the heights of power, begins to totter, then there are all sorts of enemies he's made who are ready to give him a push. And there are times when you wonder, is even the king himself in control of this process? Sometimes he didn't appear to be. Yeah. And of course, the whole thing would repeat many years later when Thomas Cromwell himself fell from power.
And he lamented the loss of both of these advisors after they were gone.
Yes. In Cromwell's case, he said he lost the best servant he'd ever had. And he said to his surviving ministers, what did you make me do? Why did you make me do this? And this was reportedly within weeks of Thomas Cromwell's fall. I think his attitude to the cardinal was probably more ambiguous, but I think it must have been a long-term regret. Very hard for a man in a position of absolute power to ever say, I made a mistake, but easy for him to turn around and blame other people.
My guest today is novelist Hilary Mantel, the winner of the 2018 Peggy V. Helmreich Distinguished Author Award. She's the author of Wolf Hall, Bring Up the Bodies, the two existing books of the Thomas Cromwell, what will be a trilogy, and forthcoming this coming year will be The Mirror and the Light, the final edition of this trilogy. And so as we've been talking about his fall, this is what you've been writing about the last few years.
That's right. I've been working on the book since around about 2006. It's been a huge commitment and didn't start off as a trilogy. Started off as one novel. And then I began to perceive the complexities of the story. It flowered out from the middle and turned into a trilogy. I'm now almost there with the final book. I hope to finish early in the spring. And by the way, it's become a TV series. And
yes, of course. Yes, which you adapted the screenplay for.
Two stage plays.
Yeah.
So a second TV series to cover this last book of the trilogy is in prospect. And I shall make a start on a stage play as soon as I'm done. Well, no, to be truthful, I already have made the start. I'm quite keen to get that underway as soon as possible. You see, for the last 2-3 years, I've been sitting in a room by myself writing, and I'm quite anxious to get out and work with other people again.
I wanted to ask you about adapting the screenplay for the BBC's Wolf Hall series, which we saw on Masterpiece and PBS here in America. Was that your first screenwriting?
Now, I must say straight off, I didn't write that myself. I'd love to be able to take the credit.
You were listed as a...
The screenwriter was Peter Strawn and director Peter Kosminski, who were just both of them a dream to work with. But it was the first thing that I had adapted for the screen. You know how it is with the novels. Many people take options on books, but it's quite hard to get anything through to completion. And so this was the first one that actually turned into a production.
You sound like you liked the collaborative process involved.
Yes. I didn't have much to do with the making of the TV series, but I was there as a backup during the writing process. But the screenwriter actually caught on with the most amazing speed to the whole period and how it should feel and what was possible for people to think and know in that era. There are lots of people who can master historical detail, but there aren't so many people who can just quickly get on top of the whole context so that you can trust them not to strike a false note. And Peter Strawn's scripts were very finished, even in their first draft. It was great to read. And then, you know, I suppose the problem is you've got 6 parts. Well, it was a big story to tell in 6 parts, and I would have loved to have had 8 parts, but you have to make these compromises.
Well, we'll look forward to that, and we're looking forward to The Mirror and the Light, because this is, we've watched Cromwell negotiate, you know, the treacheries of the English court so deftly, and then it all falls apart in the book you're currently working on, doesn't it?
Well, it's not quite like that.
Oh, you don't think so?
Really, it's his rise and rise until he gets right to the top of the tree. The king makes him an earl. And this is April 1540. But then in July 1540, he's in the Tower of London waiting for the executioner. So it all falls apart with astonishing rapidity. But most of the book is the story of his continued rise to power. But the higher he climbs, the more people are there snapping at his heels. And it's also the story of Henry's third marriage to Jane Seymour, which is the marriage that produces what he most wants in the world, which is a son to succeed him on the throne. Unfortunately, in giving birth to the child, Jane dies. So Henry is on the search for a fourth wife. And it's the story of how his alliance with the German state of Cleves is negotiated. And Anne of Cleves comes over to England. Everyone's hopes are very high. And Henry takes an instant dislike to her. And he has to go through with the marriage. This has a lot to do with Cromwell's fall, but it's not, you know, as people often think, it's the sole reason for it. It's a lot more complicated than that. But it is a really intriguing story. And Henry actually married his fifth wife, Catherine Howard, on the day that Thomas Cromwell was executed. Mm. I've managed to squeeze all six wives somehow into my story. Even Catherine Parr, Henry's sixth wife, was Lady Latimer, and because she was a widow when Henry married her. So she forms part of the story too. It was a little game I had with myself. You've got to stop 7 years before Henry's death. You've got to stop in 1540. But can you get all the six wives in? And the answer is yes, just about.
Take us back to your start. You studied law. You worked as a social worker for years before marrying and moving first to Botswana, then Saudi Arabia. Were you always writing during that early part of your career, or was it after the move abroad that you really began seriously writing?
No, I began writing when I was 22, when I was about a year out of university. And I took my work with me around the world, and I was actually writing for 10 years before I seriously put anything forward for publication. So it was like a long apprenticeship I was serving to myself. But it does go way back in my life. And I was published in the mid-1980s.
And of course, those first books were, I think, somewhat based on your work as a social worker pretty early. But I want to ask about your most recent book, the story collection, The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher. And
yes.
One of the first, I think it's the first story, Sorry to Disturb. That seems like that's based on perhaps an earlier novel and your time in Saudi Arabia.
Yes, I wrote a book called 8 Months on Gaza Street, somewhat based on my time in Saudi Arabia, using my own experience, but a whole invented set of characters. And, you know, I had this little offcut. It's something that, yes, the story is very close to life. You could almost call it memoir. And I returned to this because, you know, I think what drives a short story is trying to just make sense of a bit of your past. You have these unanswered questions and you think, well, why don't I tell myself a story about it? Maybe that will clarify things. You don't necessarily get your answers, but you hope you've produced something pleasurable to the reader in the meanwhile.
I have to ask about the title story, The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher. As I was reading it, I was thinking one of the great joys of the Thomas Cromwell books is how you bring Thomas Cromwell to life, this political fixer who, you know, has this loyalty, and you make him so sympathetic as he's moving through all of these vipers, if you will, within the court. And yet you make an assassin of Margaret Thatcher and a woman who sympathizes with him, also very sympathetic in this short story.
Well, maybe, with respect, maybe sympathy isn't quite the right word.
It's okay.
More, I think, about trying to get inside the character and look out through their eyes while you're in the space of that fiction. And with Thomas Cromwell, what I'm always saying is, well, I'm saying to the reader, what would you do if you had this man's decisions, his dilemmas, if you had his background, if you were confronted by these challenges, how would you sort it out? So once you put the reader right there, at the character's elbow, I think they begin to experience things a little differently. So they're not looking for heroes or villains anymore. They're just looking to get through the day. And that's a bit the case with my gunman in the short story. He's just looking to get his assassination done. And he intrudes into the household, let in by a young woman who thinks he's a photographer. And then out of what she takes to be his photographer's bag, he takes his gun. And there they are. tied together for the space of this couple of hours while she's waiting to get Mrs. Thatcher in his sights. So they have to, as it were, negotiate around each other. She has to, in a sense, placate him. But then they find great solace and comfort in both of them having a go at Mrs. Thatcher's character and record from their rather different points of view. And yes, they find all sorts of things in common. So in a way, it's that old favourite. It's an odd couple story. And the story of, it's almost like two people who find themselves stranded on a station platform or stuck in a lift together. They have to make the best of each other somehow. And again, this is the, I won't say it's based on something that almost happened, but it's based on something I witnessed watching from my own bedroom window in an apartment in Windsor, Mrs. Thatcher come out of the small hospital where she'd had treatment for an eye condition and walk slowly through the garden, graciously inclining her head to the staff who were lined up. And, you know, the instant thought going through my head, does she know how bright and large that head of hers is looming? If it weren't me standing here, but just someone else with a different intention, armed with a gun, not with a pen, what would be the consequence of this? Well, that was a long time ago now, and it took me years and years to find a way to tell the story, because it's a story of something that didn't happen.
Yeah, but it sounds like you were like the woman whose house was invaded. You were no great fan of Margaret Thatcher as well.
Well, a story like that has to be driven by a certain amount of animosity and venom, I think.
Hilary Mantel, thank you very much for joining us. Historical novelist Hilary Mantel speaking with us back in December when she received the Peggy V. Helmrich Distinguished Author Award. She's best known for her historical novels on the life of Thomas Cromwell, the books Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. The final novel in the trilogy, which is highly awaited, The Mirror and the Light, is due out in March of 2020. By the way, this year's winner of the Helmrich Distinguished Author Award is biographer and historian Stacy Schiff. She's the author of biographies on Saint-Exupéry, Cleopatra, A Life, Vera, Mrs. Vladimir Nabokov, and the history The Witches, Salem, 1692. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.